This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
A best of Radio EcoShock replay. They call it the Great Acceleration. In 1950, human activity departed from the old cycle of ice and warmer times into a new geological age. We do not know what it will be like or how far it will go towards an ice-free world. But now we have the formula in new science presented in this program. Then we go to Australia, where burning heat, searing heat, has created the ultimate fire conditions. That will happen more and more, not only in Australia, but in North America, the Mediterranean, and Russia. We'll talk extreme fires. I'm Alex Smith. Get ready with Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock.
Continuing human interference in the natural systems of planet Earth could lead to, quote, abrupt changes in the Earth system that could trigger societal collapse. Now, that's not from a conspiracy blog, but in a scientific journal article published February 10th. And there's a lot more in that big picture from authors Owen Gaffney and Will Steffen. Owen Gaffney has a technical background as an astronautic engineer. He's a hybrid between an author of scientific papers and a communicator of big science issues. Gaffney aids the Future Earth Project. He's also the director of international media and strategy at the Stockholm Resilience Center. From Stockholm, Owen, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks very much. Yeah, it's nice to be here.
In 2014, we had German journalist Christian Schwagerl announce the Anthropocene with his new book. What is the Anthropocene, and when did scientists realize we had entered a new geologic age?
Okay, so I guess the Anthropocene is the age of humans, and I guess that, in a nutshell, is a good starting point for a discussion. And what do we mean by the age of humans? Well, you know, technically geologists split Earth into various time periods. You know, the Jurassic is possibly the most famous, and the Triassic, the Permian. And, the last 11,700 years, Earth came out of an ice age and into a new geological epoch, the Holocene, which has been a remarkably stable period in Earth's history. And almost as soon as we came out of that stable period, agriculture emerged because hunter-gatherers could predict the temperature year on year, and planting crops suddenly made more sense. And from that, we had villages and towns and civilization flourishing. So we've been in this Holocene for 11,000 years, and now humans are changing the Earth system to such a degree that scientists say, well, actually, we're no longer in the Holocene. We're in a new geological epoch, the Anthropocene.
The deniers always say, Owen, that Earth has seen many climate changes. Prior to human intervention, briefly, what were the major causes of those heating and cooling periods?
Yeah, so I should say first that the geological epochs and geological changes are not always directly related to climate. Other events can cause a shift in a geological epoch. You know, a new evolutionary direction for species suddenly appears in the sedimentary record in the rocks, and this might signify a new geological epoch in some shape or form. But yeah, but many of them, yeah, are due to climate change. And so what causes the climate to change? Well, we have astronomical forces. We have the changes in Earth's tilt and its axis and its orbit around the sun, changes in the sun's heat output. We have other gravitational effects from Saturn and Jupiter, and also all blending to cause these astronomical changes. You know, a huge meteorite impact or asteroid impacts can knock Earth out of joint. Volcanic eruptions. So several of the cooler episodes in the Holocene over the last few thousand years, they've been caused by a spate of volcanic eruptions, putting huge amounts of sulfates, small particles, into the upper atmosphere, blocking the heat from the sun and cooling the planet marginally for a period. So these are the kind of natural forcings. Then you have tectonic forcings too. As continents collide, they can cut off oceans or cut an ocean in two. and then the ocean currents move in different directions, and then you get heat redistributed around the planet in a different way, or continents rip apart and open up new channels, and again heat can be redistributed in different ways, and then, you know, the Earth system then is dynamic and shifts around to this new order. And you can get a shift in the climate and other things. You know, you get evolutionary shifts, you know, shifts to other parts of the cycle, the, you know, nitrogen cycle, the water cycle, the sedimentary cycle, etc.
Well, you mentioned that we've been lucky enough to have about 11,000 years of relative stability to the point where we can say, well, this is sea level. We're not used to sea levels going way up and way down as they have in the past. But you do say in the paper, quote, Homo sapiens evolved during a rather unusual state of potential instability in Earth's history. So was the climate already potentially unstable?
Yeah. So we've been lulled into a false sense of security. So the Holocene has been remarkably stable, and a lot of Earth system scientists talk about this remarkable stability, which is true. But if we zoom out a little bit, you know, the Holocene is part of the Quaternary period and another level up. And the Quaternary, we've been in for about 2.5 million years. And during this period, we've gone into deep ice ages and then come out of them into these relatively warm periods called interglacials, and then back into deep ice ages, like a tick-tock cycle every 40,000 years for a while, and then every 100,000 years, and all largely related to Earth's orbit around the sun, pushing us slight shifts in it every and Earth's tilts and on its axis, and very, very slight shifts, which are measurable, can push Earth in and out of these ice ages. And this is actually a little bit unusual in that for millions and millions of years, Earth can go into deep ice ages with nothing, or very, very warm periods where there's very little ice, if any ice on the planet, very stable for millions of years. Then suddenly, for 2.5 million years, we're in this period of just tick-tocking, just a, you know, slight forcings can shift us. And in the midst of this tick-tock cycle, suddenly emerges humans, Homo sapiens, on the plains of the Rift Valley in eastern Africa. And now, 200,000 years later, they're affecting the Earth system so profoundly that we're moving beyond the Earth system envelope of the Holocene, and in fact, moving beyond the envelope of these interglacial cycles into, you know, uncharted waters.
What is the Great Acceleration?
So back in 2004, a group of scientists working at the International Geosphere Biosphere Program published a synthesis, and it's this huge green book, academic text on the state of the Earth system. And, you know, the International Geosphere Biosphere Program at that stage had been running for about, since 87, so, you know, about 17, 18 years. They published this synthesis, and the program really brought together a lot of researchers working on oceanography and cryospheric research, yeah, the ice sheets, the atmospheric research, land use, and looking at the changes in the Holocene, and particularly this late Holocene, and what people had begun to call the Anthropocene. And they put together a series of graphs in there, 24 graphs, and 12 of the graphs were looking at socioeconomic change since 1800, since the start of the Industrial Revolution. And looking at population growth, GDP, foreign direct investment, dams, farming, changes to the nitrogen cycle through using fertilizers, and tourism, globalization, as marked out by the number of McDonald's that had sprouted up. And then from these 12 graphs, there's another 12 graphs, sort of counterpart to them, looking at Earth system change, greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, nitrous oxide, methane, and changes to the water cycle, changes to biodiversity, changes to land use, deforestation, and changes to the oceans and biogeochemical cycles. And what's remarkable about these, all running from 1800, is that around 1950, they were growing steadily from 1800 onwards, and definitely significant growth compared with pre-industrial. But it really was in 1950 that marks the beginning of something really remarkable, where all of these graphs, all 24, just suddenly start bending upwards and accelerating, and then, until this day, you know, continuing to accelerate. And it's quite obvious that this socioeconomic system is driving huge change in the Earth system. So this was known colloquially as the Great Acceleration. I think it was coined Great Acceleration at the meeting in Germany in 2006. And then in 2015, Will Steffen and co-author of mine and colleagues Cornelia Ludwig and Lisa Deutsch and Wendy Broadgate, we published an updated version of the Great Acceleration graphs. We wanted to see what had happened 10 years on from the first publication and see if there had been any changes in the trajectory, to re-examine the data, see if there's any better data out there. And so we published, and again, I mean, what we saw was that the pattern is largely continuing, very much so. We're still in the midst of this great acceleration. What we also tried to do was to look at some of the drivers as well, like is it population growth per se, or is it something different? And we were able to establish that, you know, population growth is obviously an important factor, but that by and large the biggest factor is consumption and production of 1 billion people living in developed world in industrialized societies, as opposed to the 6 billion or so living in less developed societies.
We are going to talk about your large-scale formula for our current situation. But first, Owen, I can't get past figure 2 in your paper. On one side is a kind of universe of climate change with ups and downs of temperature, like the ice ages and hotter periods we talked about. But then we seem to have left that orbit for spaces unknown. Is that accurate?
Yeah. So in figure 2 in the paper, we show these basins of attraction. In complex systems, we draw these basins of attraction where you're pulled like a sort of gravitational force into a recurring cycle, and then slight changes can put you out of that cycle and into another cycle. So in the figure, and so it's almost like a sort of an Earth's orbit around the sun, but what we're talking about here is Earth's orbit around its into different stable states. And so we have the big glacial state. And then every 100,000 years, we will push into another orbit. You know, the gravitational forces will pull us into a different state, these interglacials. So we try to depict this as these cycles every 100,000 years. And we have a huge amount of evidence growing from the Earth system community that what's happening right now, since the start of the Great Acceleration, you know, caused by this huge socioeconomic growth, is that we're pushing Earth out of the basin of attraction of the Holocene, out of the basin of attraction of the interglacials, into something else. And we mark on it, well, we could be pulling ourselves into some sort of Anthropocene stable state, if such a state exists. We don't know if there's what kind of stable states are out there, and what kind of pull will, what kind of attraction will take us into these stable states. And then I suppose far off on the horizon is this risk of going into the greenhouse attractor, which we know is a stable state of the Earth system. We know Earth has remained in that state for millions of years. So there's always that risk that what are the drivers or the pulls that would pull you into that. And these are still, you know, unknown questions that remain to be answered, which is why humanity is taking quite a big risk pulling ourselves beyond this interglacial boundary.
Well, one little problem along the way to that stable greenhouse state is the possibility of a sixth great extinction, which many scientists have warned is already in progress. I did interview Anthony Barnosky from the University of California about that back in 2009, and I noticed his 2012 paper is referenced in your paper. How big a risk is that, in your opinion?
Yeah, so again, as part of the Earth system change, we are the start of the, you know, a sixth mass extinction. I mean, and this is, to me, is quite incredible. You know, the last time we had a mass extinction on this scale was 66 million years ago, when an asteroid hit Earth and wiped out the non-avian dinosaurs. So, you know, this is the kind of scale humans are operating on. So this is largely down to land use, you know, land clearing. And we are causing extinction rates at rates, you know, 10 to 100 times faster than the background rate. And, of course, at the Stockholm Resilience Center, we talk about resilience a lot, the resilience of a system, and, you know, how a system can take knocks and then return to its normal state, like a spring. You pull a spring and it'll spring back to normal. But, you know, as you keep stretching the spring, it's not going to come back to normal as much, and it's not going to bounce back in the same way. And as you change a system, you can reduce its resilience. So this is biodiversity. We know biodiversity enhances resilience. We know that if you have many, many species, then an ecosystem forest with many, many species can take knocks. It can bounce back easier than a system with very few species in it. So we're looking at the stability of the Earth system as a global interconnected system. And the concern is, though, that as we reduce biodiversity, then we reduce the resilience of that system, and we're already pushing the system in myriad ways. You know, greenhouse gas emissions, ocean acidification, the changes to the nitrogen cycle and eutrophication. So what we have been able to say and establish about the Earth system in normal circumstances may not apply in these new situations.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I am Alex Smith. My guest is Owen Gaffney from the Stockholm Resilience Center. We're talking about leaving Earth's past behind, entering a new age created by human beings. Oh, and let's get to the new formula presented in this paper, the Anthropocene Equation. To be frank, it's a tough one for listeners to grasp, I think, and maybe even harder on radio. Why don't we start with this idea? Why is a mega formula needed?
So I guess when we published the paper in 2015 on the Great Accelerations, we were doing a lot of talks, lectures to the scientific community and public talks, and writing about it in the media and the scientific press. And we would use similar phrases to kind of sum up what this great acceleration is, what's these thousands, tens of thousands of data points mean, which this Earth system where everything's connected to everything else. Now humans are intrinsically connected into it and affecting it. And we're trying to sum this up in a kind of soundbite or just a sentence, and we'd say things like, humans now rival the great forces of nature, or humans are the prime driver of change on Earth, or we're the size of an asteroid impact, or we're like an ice age. And it occurred to me that they are all very true. They sound rhetorical, these kinds of statements, and they're open to misinterpretation, I think. For example, you could say, we rival the great forces of nature. Okay, so one of the great forces of nature are tides, and the energy produced by tides is usually greater than the energy by humans, for example. But in terms of shifting the Earth system, we are miles greater actually than a lot of forces. Tides are net zero; they don't change the rate of change of the Earth system. Well, maybe I'm getting ahead of myself, because when I was thinking about these statements we were making, I thought, well, is there a way we could formalize a statement around the Anthropocene that communicates more specifically the impact of humans? And so as I was thinking about it, I was thinking particularly about the rate of change of the Earth system, the speed the Earth system is changing, a bit like a car is going at 50 miles an hour or 100 miles an hour. So the miles per hour is the rate of change. So I thought the Earth system rate of change is something good, because we can look at this. It's something we can measure the various components of. The biodiversity is part of the Earth system, changes to the ice sheets, changes to the oceans, changes to biogeochemistry, changes to the atmospheric concentrations of greenhouse gases. The key components of the Earth system that keep it functioning, we can measure the rate of change there for each one of those, and compare that to a baseline, and be able to say then what are the key drivers of that rate of change now. So that was really the starting point. That's why I thought we needed something like this.
So with this updated formula, can we now know what rate of human influence can continue and still allow a relatively safe habitable space on this planet?
Yeah, so our conclusion... maybe I could take us through the equation very briefly, because basically we start off with, for the last 4 billion years since Earth has had a biosphere, a sort of living resource on Earth, the rate of change of the Earth system has been a function of astronomical forces, the Earth's orbit around the sun, geophysical forces, volcanic eruptions and tectonic movements, and internal dynamics, as new species evolve, or as the system settles or moves into new states, and so now we're saying that back back in 1999, an academic, Hans-Joachim Schellnhuber from Potsdam Institute, he published a paper saying that, now you have to include humans in here, because humans are now a major driver. And so the rate of change of the Earth system is not just a function of astronomical and geophysical forces and these internal dynamics. It's also human forces. But he published that paper just 1 year before Paul Crutzen and Eugene Stürmer suggested that we were now in the Anthropocene. And 5 years before this book I mentioned earlier in 2004, when the Earth system and global change showing the great accelerations, and a decade before the first publication of the Planetary Boundaries paper. So when you look at the evidence in those papers and compare the current rate of change of the Earth system caused by humans compared with the background rate over the last 7,000 years, for example, you see that humans absolutely dwarf all other forcings by several orders of magnitude in most cases, from biodiversity to climate change to ocean acidification. So we can say that now the rate of change of the Earth system is a function of humans. The other forcings are still there, but they're orders of magnitude smaller, so they don't play a big role in the equation at all. I mean, you can discount them currently. That might change in the next few weeks if we had a massive, you know, Toba-like super eruption. But currently, we can say, you know, for the last 40 years that's been the case.
So in the conclusion of this paper, it says, quote, "It remains unclear whether anthropogenic forcing is significant enough to drive the Earth system into a greenhouse state. That surprises me a little from some scientists I've interviewed. I thought our entry into a greenhouse state is more or less a given. What is the hope of avoiding it?"
Okay, so when we talk about a greenhouse state, we're talking about a state with very little ice on Earth. And these they have had these stable states before where carbon dioxide levels have been very, very high. And we've had, you know, hippopotamus on the poles. And there's palm trees and, you know, lush forests there, and you know, sea levels would be, you know, at least 70 meters higher than today, and the Earth would be operating in a very, very different way. There's some scientists, James Hansen, formerly at NASA, and others have said that yes, we could have this runaway warming to pull us into that state. But the jury's out whether whether we can burn enough fossil fuels to fully do that, to fully tip us over into that state. And we don't really know enough. You know, as I said earlier, we've sort of reduced the resilience of the Earth system through biodiversity loss and changing the nitrogen cycle and water cycle. We're pumping out greenhouse gases, and we're in this no analog state. We can't say for certain what can happen. The big concern is that as temperatures get warmer, then the carbon sinks. So we pump out 10 gigatons of carbon every year. 5 gigatons of that carbon stays in the atmosphere, and it's cumulative. It stays there for thousands of years, so it just builds up and up and up as we emit more. But 5 gigatons is absorbed by the oceans and the land, so around 2.5 each. And these are really super important carbon sinks. They provide a huge service to industrialized societies. Yet, in a warmer world, will they remain carbon sinks, or will they become carbon sources, is a big open question, and what will tip them? And, you know, there's some research out just before Christmas saying that even the warmer world we have at the we're 1 degree above pre-industrial, heading rapidly towards 1.5. The research showed that by 2050, as we get to 1.5 and above, then carbon in soils will start getting emitted to the atmosphere, so causing more of a problem. And as we potentially hit other tipping points in the Earth system, when we get to 3 degrees above pre-industrial, then we see places like the Amazon potentially dying back and becoming savanna and emitting large amounts of carbon. So you get these carbon feedbacks, these positive feedback loops where, you know, a warmer world begets an even warmer world, then potentially pulling you into this this hothouse attractor, where it'd be, even if you stopped emitting greenhouse gases, you have this concern that the system itself is going to pull you naturally towards these this new basin of attraction. So, and this is alarming. We don't have enough information on exactly what will cause these kind of state changes, but we are taking risks as we wander into the unknown.
Well, I've used up quite a bit of your time. I hope you have just a couple more minutes. I want to ask you, as we finish off, about your views on the pivotal role of Hans-Joachim Schellenhuber, or John as he's known in the UK. Where does he stand in this exploration?
So John is extremely concerned about where we're heading politically. I think that in 2015, we made huge progress with the Paris Agreement on climate, with the Sustainable Development Goals. And there was huge, huge momentum and huge amount of energy. And that momentum is continuing. I think we have, the world is rapidly beginning to decarbonize. And the Global Carbon Project, one of Future Earth's projects that I'm affiliated with, we've shown that for the last 3 years, the growth in emissions has stalled. So there's been a huge, huge effort to address our fossil fuel emissions. I should say the growth in emissions of fossil fuels, and that's unexpected. Actually, the scientists didn't think this could happen; they hadn't predicted it, and it's largely down to China's huge efforts to control its emissions, to move rapidly away from coal. And then you can see sort of knock-on effects of that, of coal companies in Australia and the U.S. who are betting on China's increase in coal use. These companies are going bankrupt. We've seen six bankruptcies of the major coal companies in the U.S. since 2012, and the U.S. as well. It has been reducing its emissions, making big progress there. So there are some positive signs that we can deal with this, but will it happen fast enough? Emissions really need to peak by 2020 at the latest, and then fall precipitously to 2050. And we're talking about some sort of we need a carbon law of halving emissions every decade from 2020, 2030, 2040 to 2050 to get down to zero as rapidly as possible.
We've been talking with Owen Gaffney. He's a science communicator for the Future Earth Project at futureearth.org. Owen also directs media and strategy for the Stockholm Resilience Center. All the while, he makes his own contribution to science through articles like this one, titled The Anthropocene Equation. Find links to all this in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Owen Gaffney, thank you so much for your explanations. It really helps.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. In recent years, extremely dangerous and damaging fires have dominated the news in many parts of the world. Just last month, a major forest fire ripped through Chile. Last year, the oil sands city of Fort McMurray, Canada, was almost destroyed. Are mega fires increasing? Will we see even more as the world warms? There's new research out about that. The title of a paper published February 6, 2017, in the journal Nature is Human Exposure and Sensitivity to Globally Extreme Wildfire Events. We've reached the lead author, Dr. David Bowman. David Bowman is professor of environmental change biology at the University of Tasmania's School of Plant Science. He's a visiting fellow or adjunct professor at three other Australian universities. From Hobart, Tasmania, David Bowman, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, hi. How are you going?
Oh, it's going pretty good here. Now, before we get to the science, David, you have a personal reason for studying fires. Could you tell us about that?
That's right. On the 7th of February, 1967, an extreme fire event occurred that engulfed really the whole of the Hobart area and very nearly burnt the city down. And that event, the 1967 event, really was what I was brought up with. I was trained by a Tasmanian fire ecologist, and there weren't many in those days, and his life was completely shaped by the 1967 event. You know, when you have motor vehicles melted and suburbs severely impacted and so on, and 64 people dying in a small community, isolated community in those days, it still actually leaves a tremendous legacy. And part of the commemoration is that people from 50 years ago who were kids are still traumatised by what we call the 1967 Black Tuesday fire.
That is amazing, and I know what you mean. It has a very big impact. I've done